All right, in our study of Deuteronomy, we've come to chapter 7. So I'll read the chapter. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars and break down their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images and burn their carved images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples, but because the Lord loves you. Because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Therefore know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and mercy for a thousand generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. And he repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. Therefore you shall keep the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments, which I command you today to observe them. Then it shall come to pass, because you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant and the mercy which he swore to your fathers. And he will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your land, your grain and your new wine and your oil, the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flock, and the land of which he swore to your fathers to give you. And the Lord will take away from you all sickness, and will afflict you with none of the terrible diseases of Egypt, which you have known, but will lay them on all those who hate you. Also you shall destroy all the peoples whom the Lord your God delivers over to you. Your eye shall have no pity on them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. If you should say in your heart, "These nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them?" You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember well what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt, the great trials which your eyes saw, the signs and the wonders, the mighty hand and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So shall the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. Moreover, the Lord your God will send the hornet among them until those who are left, who hide themselves from you, are destroyed. You shall not be terrified of them. For the Lord your God, the great and awesome God, is among you. And the Lord your God will drive out those nations before you little by little. You will be unable to destroy them at once, lest the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will defeat them, deliver them over to you, and will inflict defeat upon them until they are destroyed. And he will deliver their kings into your hand, and you will destroy their name from under heaven. No one shall be able to stand against you until you have destroyed them. You shall burn the carved images of their gods with fire. You shall not covet the silver or gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, lest you be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. Nor shall you bring an abomination into your house, lest you be doomed to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest it and utterly abhor it, for it is an accursed thing. Now, we saw last week that this section of Deuteronomy, starting in chapter 5, contains, well, first the law, the Ten Commandments, which were delivered in chapter 5, and then in chapter 6 and following, an exposition of the law. That's really the core of the book of Deuteronomy, a careful explanation of what the Ten Commandments mean in their individual and civic life. And I suggested last week that the first section that follows the giving of the Ten Commandments, so that's chapters 6 to 11, is especially devoted to an exposition of the first commandment. And that's fairly clear that these chapters cover generally the idea of faithfulness to God, the wholehearted devotion to God that we saw last week, right? The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. But specifically, it seems fairly clear as we go through these chapters, I hope it will seem clear as we go through these chapters, that there's an emphasis on the turning away from idolatry, on the one hand, and positively giving ourselves wholly over to God. And I think that's fairly clear in the chapter we just read. They are supposed to destroy the idols of the nations. And on the other hand, they're supposed to turn to God and look to Him and trust in Him for His faithfulness. So that's the context of where we are in Deuteronomy. And today I want to look at this chapter in three sections. So the first section is verses 1 through 11. And that will occupy maybe three quarters of our time. There's actually quite a bit in here. The other two sections are important, but involve some repetition of what we've seen before. And I think I'll spend less time on them. So let's focus first on the verses 1 through 11, which I've titled Holiness and Idolatry. Okay, so you may pick up the idolatry part, but the holiness or the idea of consecration actually plays a significant part in the whole of the passage. Okay, so the opening verses talk about something we've seen before. Remember, this is a sermon, or it's actually Deuteronomy's series of sermons. In sermons, there's often a repetition. You know, you want to make the point clear, so you say it over and over again. And here there's a repetition of the fact that God is the one who will bring them into the land. Now, there's an emphasis, lest we forget, that it is God's power that does this, and it's an encouragement to them. It's a point to which Moses returns at the end of the chapter, that they needn't fear because God will do this. And He will cast out, it says, nations that are greater and mightier than you. Okay? So, could be intimidating, but it's God who does this, and that's the encouragement that they're to have. And it says, He will deliver them over to you, verse 2. So again, the emphasis on the working of God. And even at the end of the section, at the end of the chapter actually, verses 23 and 24, God says, He will deliver the kings into your hand. In fact, so much will He deliver the kings into your hand that their name will be destroyed from under heaven. So if you're a king, that's like the worst thing that can happen to you. I mean, besides being destroyed, is to have your name wiped out, right? They wanted to leave a memory of themselves in the land, but God says they will no longer be remembered, except, of course, as the ones whom God had defeated. So they're encouraged here that this will happen, and there's a list of the ites that are to be defeated, the Hittites and so on. They're actually 10 times in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, is a list like this. The fullest list is in Genesis. It has 10 nations. This has 7, which probably has the idea of perfection behind it. And in Stephen's sermon in Acts 7, he refers to the 7 nations whom they destroyed. Some of the lists have as few as 3 nations, probably the most prominent ones. But in any case, this sense that God will completely wipe out the inhabitants of the land, and He is the one, He is the power behind it. That's the preface then to the commandments that form the core of what we'll look at in verses 1 through 11. Okay, what are the commandments in this core? Well, it's not typical Sunday school material. So, you know, if anyone faint of heart wants to get up and leave and do something else, it's okay. Because what He tells them to do is to wipe out the nations. Okay? It's, I suppose, would be called ethnic cleansing by the United Nations now. And we've seen this already in Deuteronomy. We saw it back in chapter 2 and discussed it there. But I want to dwell a little bit more on it because it's explained in slightly different terms here, and the explanation as well as the connection to the Lord and our holiness in Him is an important aspect that we didn't see before. So it says in verses 2 and following, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. And that phrase, utterly destroy them, has reference to this idea we talked about before. The Hebrew word is cherem. It has to do with devotion to destruction. It has the idea of consecration in it. That's why holiness is a good idea here. Holiness has the idea of consecration behind it, but here the consecration is a consecration to wrath and to judgment. Now, this is the way Meredith Klein puts it. Every body and everything that was consecrated to idols rather than to the service of God must be consecrated to the wrath of God. So that's the sense of this utter destruction here that is referred to in verse 2 and is, in a sense, characteristic of the whole description of their activities. They're viewed as offering a sacrifice to God, if you will, but it is giving these people over to the wrath of God. Now, specifically, it's spelled out here that they are to make no covenant with them in verse 2. Okay, I'm going to try to come back to these in terms of thinking through what they would mean for us, but that commandment about not to make a covenant with them is referred to in Judges 2. A lot of these are repeated either passages before this or after this in the biblical account. They're not to intermarry with them, okay, in verses 3 and 4, and the reason that's given there I'll try to come back to. And that problem of intermarriage, I'll just point out, was a problem which plagued Israel throughout its lifetime. Think of Solomon and the way he disobeyed at this point and compromised the nation severely. It's was a problem even until the time of the return from the exile. So I put up references there in Ezra 9 and Nehemiah 13. And of course it comes up in the New Testament as well. I'll try to come back to that. But here is a command not to intermarry with these nations. And of course that would be a special case of not making any covenants, because a marriage covenant would be one of the things that was already forbidden. Furthermore, it says that they are to destroy their altars, their pillars, and their asherim. Okay, so that's described in verses 5. Wooden images, in the original it's asherim. So the altars, I think, are fairly easy to understand. So these would be the places of worship. The pillars are some kind of a physical representation of the gods of Canaan. And the asherim are specifically used in their worship practices and connected with the goddess Asherah, who is a fertility goddess. Okay? A lot of this you probably don't really want to know more about in terms of what they did, but that they're supposed to destroy what's usually called the remnants of idolatry. Okay? It's not simply the practice of idolatry, but the things that would be left behind after the idols were gone, or the idolaters, I should say, were gone. After the idolaters are slain, they're not supposed to stop there, but they're actually supposed to go further and destroy the remnants of idolatry. And it's even applied toward the end of the passage. I'm cheating a little bit, but as I said, there's repetition. So if you look down toward the end in verses 25 and 26, again, there's a reference to burning the carved images of their gods with fire, so that would be the idols, strictly speaking. And then even the silver and gold that would be the silver and gold plating, I guess we would say, on the idols, they're not to take that for themselves either. They're supposed to destroy that as well. That's the specific commandment that Achan violated, by the way. Remember in Joshua when they were fighting and they were compromised in battle, they were compromised because of the sin of Achan, and it was specifically this, taking the silver and gold, that had been forbidden. In fact, the same word covet or desire is used there for Achan's sin is used here. Now, those are the specific aspects. It is what would draw our attention, first of all, of course, is the destruction of the people. They're supposed to slaughter everyone. But the commandment is broader than that, and those applications in terms of covenants and other remnants of idolatry, the remnants of idolatry help us to understand the purpose, and that's what I want to turn to next. The short way to say this in terms of understanding what's going on here is that God is really using the Israelites and their destruction of the Canaanites as a picture of God's wrath against sin. So ultimately, the utter destruction is a picture of hell. It is a giving one over to the wrath of God, because one refuses to glorify God in this life, then in a sense they are forced to glorify God in judgment, as if you want to put it that way. It's more or less the way the Apostle Paul puts it in Romans chapter 9. So if you want to step back and ask what's going on here, it's a very sober picture in a specific historical instance in terms of the history of redemption of the great last judgment and the casting of idolaters into the wrath of God, or giving them over to the wrath of God. Now, let's think, though, a little bit about the reasons that are connected with the specific historical instance. So first, in terms of the history and background of this, is the curse on Canaan. So you remember after the flood, when Noah was describing the blessings on two sons, but he also gave a curse on Canaan, who was the descendant of Ham. And that's given in Genesis 9, somewhere on the board there. It's at the top. Genesis 9, and then the descendants of Canaan are described in Genesis 10, and it's that list of 10 nations. The subset of that 10 is given in verse 1 here. So the historical background would be the curse that was given on Canaan, but specifically, and we talked about this in chapter 2, specifically was the fact that God had promised the land to Abraham. And remember in Genesis 15, when God promised the land to Abraham, he said, not yet. And why did he say not yet? He said not yet because the iniquity of the Amorites wasn't yet full. Okay? So in fact, hundreds of years passed between the giving of that promise to Abraham and the time of the destruction that's described here. 400 years in Egypt is what God says to Abraham, but that doesn't count the intervening years until they went to Egypt or the time since then until we get to this point. So although we may tend to say this is a terrible thing and it illustrates for us the wrath of God, and that's true, we should also realize that it illustrates the long-suffering of God. Because God waited more than 400 years, waiting and withholding his judgment. In fact, if we had a great zeal for the judgment of God, we might say, why did he wait so long? So that's the point of view here is not that God is quick to anger, but that he is slow to anger, and that he's very patient with them. And just to underline the fact that the iniquity of the Amorites was full, the Amorites there stand for all of these nations, I'll just point out, as I did last time when we looked at this in chapter 2, the reference in Leviticus 18 to the specifically the sexual sins of the nation that would cause, of the Canaanite kingdoms that would cause them to be cast out of the land. But let's look at a summary that's in Ezra chapter 9, since we looked at that other passage before. So end of the historical books, almost. Ezra, right before Nehemiah. And Esther. In Ezra 9, the context actually is this problem of intermarriage. And the sin of the people in intermarriage is being confessed. And notice verse 1, they have not separated themselves from the peoples of the land. And then there's a list of names. It actually includes some outside of Canaan, like the Ammonites and the Moabites and so on. But notice specifically the reference that's given to the idolatry in verse 11. Well, back up to verse 10. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you commanded by your servants the prophets, saying, the land which you are entering to possess is an unclean land, and the uncleanness of the peoples of the lands with their abominations, which... Let's see if I can get the grammar of that read correctly. The land which you are entering to possess is an unclean land, with the uncleanness of the peoples of the land, with their abominations which have filled it from one end to another, with their impurity. So the uncleanness is spelled out further as something that fills the land from one end to another. And it's that sense of the utter detestability of the condition of the land, the way it's described as an abomination, which is a very strong word, which underlines the fact that God's wrath came on those who were in utter rebellion against him. We may not have a sense of the pollution of the land the way it communicated to the Israelites. I mean, the the idea of, you know, the ecology and all that, preserving the land from pollution, has something of a sense of it, but the land had been promised to Abraham's descendants. It was a picture of the place of righteousness, actually of the new heavens and the new earth, and the pollution then of these idolaters had to be cleansed from the land. So that's actually another reason for the judgment that was given on them. So we can go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7. So those are, you might say, external reasons why the wrath had to come on these people. But this passage in Deuteronomy 7 emphasizes especially the danger to the Israelites themselves. And that's actually what Ezra is talking about in chapter 9 also. But notice in verse 4, the danger of intermarriage. They will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Okay, so if, in fact, they didn't carry out this destruction, and in fact, historically they failed to a certain extent, then they themselves would be tempted to idolatry. And that is spelled out elsewhere in the passage also. So notice in verse 16, you shall destroy the peoples, your eyes shall have no pity on them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. And then again at the end of the passage in verse 26, nor shall you bring an abomination into your house, so this is referring to the idols, lest you be doomed to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest it and utterly abhor it, for it is an accursed thing. So there, it's even stronger than being a snare to you, because basically what it says in verse 26, lest you be doomed to destruction, is lest you be under the ban that is given over to destruction, lest you be harem the way they are. So in other words, if you take up their idols, you're Canaanites, and you're liable to the wrath of God. So that emphasis here in this passage, which is stronger than what we saw in Deuteronomy 2, underlines the danger to their own holiness, the danger to their own consecration to God, that the idolatry and the remnants of idolatry represented in their situation. Now those are, you might say, fairly negative reasons. The positive reason that the passage gives is a beautiful one, and you may prefer to remember this one over all the others. It's fine if you want to focus on this. The reason given in verse 6 is a beautiful one. You are a people, you are a holy people to the Lord your God. So you are not consecrated to wrath. You are consecrated to God. You are a holy people. And that's the reason why they couldn't go about this. Again, we may tend to focus on this for ourselves, right? Being a people holy to God, God loves us and therefore will not pour his wrath out on us. But we should remember the Godward emphasis first, which is, if you are my people, then you're not going to be tainted with idols. You're not going to be making a covenant, right? There's the idea of exclusive devotion to God. If you are my people, my holy people, then you are to love me with all your heart, and there's therefore no room for idolatry, and therefore a need for this destruction that is rather unpleasant to talk about. This passage, verses 6 and 7 and 8, is a beautiful description of God's loving choice of the nation of Israel. It is a description of election in the theological sense, not in the sense of what's coming up on Tuesday. Well, God is the only one who votes in this election, and it's not based on the qualities of the candidates. So that point is fairly clear here. So this is a national election as opposed to personal election. The Apostle Paul makes that distinction in Romans 9 through 11. We saw that some time ago. But notice how he describes it. You are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. We've seen this phrase before, but it's worth emphasizing. The idea of a special treasure is what the king would have. So the king has certain special royal treasures. And God is saying, that's what you are to me. I've chosen you. There are many peoples on the face of the earth, but I chose you. Okay. So at this point, the Israelites start to get, you know, the puffed chest. It's, you know, it's like the guy tells the young lady that he loves her and she's ready to hear about how beautiful she is and her lovely personality. But what God says is, the Lord did not set his love on you or choose you because of anything in you. Okay, so a little deflating maybe, but there's a point to it. So the love of God, taking them to be a special treasure for himself, is not because, said specifically here, you were more in number than any other people. Okay, there were only 70 of them, roughly, when they went down to Egypt. And he says, you are the least of all the peoples. There was nothing in them that provoked them to him to love them. It is a love that came out of his own free choice. And that's easier to see if you try to diagram the sentence and then sort of remove the middle part. The Lord did not set his love on you because of this, but, in verse 8, because the Lord loves you. So you get the reason? The Lord didn't love you because of this, but because the Lord loves you. That is, there is no reason intrinsic to you for why this love should be on you. It is the mere good pleasure of God. It is because God loved you. Elsewhere in the Pentateuch, God says, I didn't give you the land because you are more righteous than anyone else. He adds, you're a stiff-necked people instead. But it is here to emphasize the fact that God's love is a sovereign love. And he adds a second reason, which is, in verse 8, the oath which he swore to your fathers. Okay, he's referring to the Abrahamic covenant. And there again, it's not something that they could boast in as referring to their own characteristics, because they weren't born then. Right? There was nothing in them that caused God to swear an oath to Abraham. God is faithful to his promises, and of course, if you go back to Abraham, you'll realize that there was nothing in Abraham either. It was God's free choice. That's the emphasis here. Now, why is that encouraging to them in these circumstances? Well, the rest of the passage plays this out. It's because if that's God's free choice, then it means that God will persevere in it. Right? If it were based on something in us, or on our size, in terms of the number and the people in the nation, then we might worry that God would change his mind. But that's why in verse 9 there's a very beautiful word. It's faithful. Know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God. We have a God who loved us, not because of anything in us, and who keeps his covenant. He is faithful. Actually, verses 9 and 10 are really a restatement of, in slightly different words, of the reason annexed to the second commandment, right? Remember that the Lord repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. They're actually in the reverse order. But in verse 9, he keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandments. Okay? Thought about how long just 1,000 generations is? That covers a lot of time. And that's the emphasis on the fact that God's love, because it is freely given, is not withdrawn because of anything in man. God will persevere. God will keep covenant. That's the emphasis of this passage. And therefore, because they are a holy people, because they are given over to God in that way, they are not to give themselves over to idolatry. Now he goes on from there in the end of the passage in verse 11 to say, therefore you shall keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments. Okay? Many times the reformed understanding of God's sovereignty is criticized because it can lead to what's usually called antinomianism, which is a big word for disobeying God because you think everything's hunky-dory between you and God, right? If God is sovereign, then I don't have to do anything, I can disobey him. No. It's actually on the contrary. If God has loved us so and set his love on us, the natural response is to keep his commandments. I think we quoted last week, Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments. And that actually is spelled out further in the next passage, so I won't develop that right now. Okay, so we talked about ethnic cleansing and removing the remnants of idolatry and all that sort of thing. What does that have to do with us? Okay. Well, in the first place, in case I need to say this, it doesn't mean that the church has the power of the sword. Okay. Actually, here it wasn't the church that had the power of the sword either. The church is not to take up arms to destroy unbelievers. It's not, in fact, ethnically based at all. It's a striking fact that I hadn't noticed before when I was looking at parallels to this phrase, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth, that in Acts 15, the Council of Jerusalem, where they're talking about the place of the Gentiles, this same idea is brought up, but it's applied to the Gentiles. The Gentiles are a people that God has taken, at least a people among the Gentiles God has taken for himself. It's not all the Gentiles, but it is the gathering in of the Gentiles to be a special people. So that phrase is applied to Gentiles. The church is no longer predominantly of one ethnic group. In fact, that should be an encouragement for us not to be racially biased, to say we should go around and slay the Hittites and the Girgashites, because God saved some among many nations and is saving some among many nations. You probably didn't need to hear that. I don't think anyone was planning on that jihad in that form this week. But this passage is often criticized, or passages like this, and we talked about that before. I don't really plan to go through any further explanation of that. But I want to think about some other things that come up in the passage that are helpful for us. And this then positively, what continues for us is the forbidding of these close alliances, making a covenant with them, and specifically intermarriage. So you remember in 1 Corinthians 7, the Apostle Paul, this is only one place where the Apostle Paul and others mention this, but believer is not to marry an unbeliever. Okay, so there the passage I had in mind specifically is 7:39, as someone who is remarrying, but he says only in the Lord. Or more generally, the passage in 2 Corinthians 6, 14 and following comes to mind, that we are not to be unequally yoked. And there is not only specifically forbidding intermarriage, but it's very closely related to this idea of not making a covenant with them. Any entangling alliances with the unbeliever is to be forbidden. Now, that of course requires a lot of discretion. Okay? Jesus was accused of hanging out, I don't think that's the word in the Greek, but anyway, with publicans and sinners. And in a sense, there's a danger in looking at others who are not clean the way we would expect them to be, and thinking, oh, I'm going to keep myself separate from them. But this is not a way to rule out that sort of evangelistic outreach or compassion on those who are seeking for Christ. But it is important for us also to remember the danger of these entangling alliances. And that the language of Deuteronomy 7, which is so strong, should be a reminder to us. We are a holy people to God. We don't want to be given over to the thing that God says is to be given over to destruction. another application of this is in terms of the practice of being an iconoclast. Okay, maybe not a word we use in the literal sense that much anymore, but that's the word that's used for destruction of the remnants of idolatry. In the New Testament, an example of this would be in Acts when they burned the books that were used for sorcery. So there's a putting away of something that in a sense wasn't an idol, but was an entangling sort of thing, and something that could ensnare them. We especially think about that in connection with the Reformation. And in the connection with the Reformation, there was a revolt against the use of idols in various forms, whether it was the Mass or the things connected with the saints, like images and relics and so on. And as we were reminded in the movie on Thursday night, there were some people who took the populist approach to iconoclasm, which was that they encouraged the masses to go through and destroy the churches and all the remnants of idolatry that were inside of them. That wasn't the approach that the Calvinist wing of the Reformation took. And Calvin emphasized, an example in his sermons on this passage, emphasized the fact that it was those in authority who were to take the lead in this. It is true that it is important to remove the remnants of idolatry. I think it's hard for us to realize exactly what the situation was. Watching a movie like the Luther movie is a very helpful reminder. What it was that Calvin and Luther and the other reformers faced in terms of the amount of idolatry there. Calvin reminds us that idolatry is not merely an external thing. It's something that closely is tied to our hearts. Our hearts are, he liked to say, factories of idols. And so it was important for the Reformation especially to remove the remnants of idolatry, but you might say in an orderly way, by those who had authority. There's a nice quote from John Knox about the reason for doing so. He said, "The best way to keep the rooks from returning is to pull down their nests." Yeah, that sense of a complete reformation, a complete break from the former way of worship and service of God was necessary. Now, we may not see that as a current problem, and it is true that what's usually called gross idolatry, that is, the use of images, is much less prevalent in the churches outside of the Roman and Eastern Orthodox churches than it was then. But I have seen some indications that with a desire for sort of a postmodern approach to things, there may be more and more desire for including this sort of image usage in worship. Let me just mention one or two other things in connection with this application. What percentage of the time did I say I was going to take on this? I said 3/4, right? Pretty close to there already. So I'll try to be brief here. They're told here to show no pity. And this is especially important for those, again, who have a place of authority, because it may be difficult to exercise the righteous judgment of God, whether you're the civil magistrate or whether you have authority in the church. No one likes to act in a just way that declares someone to be a criminal or to be a sinner and to be cast outside of the church. But as Calvin says, we should not be more merciful than God will have us to be. When God declares his judgment, then we should be careful to follow it, if nothing else, for the glory of God. And there are two examples that come to mind just briefly. One is Saul in 1 Samuel 15, who was supposed to destroy the Amalekites, and in particular, Agag. But Saul thought better of it, and for that reason, he lost his kingdom. Or another example, one that Calvin gives, is in Ahab in 1 Kings 20. We've been reading this in family worship in the morning, where God was insulted because the Syrian king said that the God of Israel is the God of the hills, and therefore they would lose the battle if they fought on the plain. And so Ahab, the king of Israel, was specifically told to kill the king and to wipe out the Syrians, but he refused to do so. And in that way, he was really counting the glory of men as greater than the glory of God. Just one other application that may sound more personal, and that is the New Testament frequently uses the idea of warfare to describe our own battle against sin. So, if you like, when you think of the wiping out of the Canaanites, think of the ruthlessness with which you have to treat your own sin. Cut it off. Kill it. Don't show any pity. Read John Owen. You'll get the idea. Any comments or questions on that? Let's see. 40 out of 50 minutes. I think that's bigger than 3/4. Yes?
Well, you run the 3/4 business. You have a first 90%, second 90% problem.
Oh, okay. I'll remember that. Thank you.
Do you have any great insight, having studied this so long, in terms of apologetics approached, you know, it just seems to me to be one of the most difficult things to defend in, you know, in a discussion with a sort of, let's just say, a serious non-believer.
Right. Yeah.
You know, most of them don't have any idea what's in the Bible, so that,
Right. Yeah, I know what you mean. I remember one of the first conversations I had in my first faculty position was talking with a guy with a Jewish background. So he should have, I guess, had an answer himself. But, you know, like, what's going on here? How can you wipe out a whole series of kingdoms, actually? And I guess the short answer is No, except that it's an opportunity for us to declare what the foundation of our apologetic is, and that is, it's the will of God that determines what's right and what's wrong, and His glory is chief. But the difficulty is, if you want to say in practice, how can you explain that we don't all feel that we have the obligation to do this sort of thing? So you'd have to explain the uniqueness of the historical event here, which is why I went through that thing with the Canaanites and the prophecies and the and so on. But it is a difficult thing because we tend to be oriented toward the suffering of people, and we've seen terrible examples of ethnic cleansing. Is that the sort of thing you're getting at? Yeah. Do you have an answer?
No, I don't. Yeah. Other than what you said, but it's I think a hard thing to.
Yeah, I mean, the temptation would be to sort of dance around it, but I mean, ultimately, the answer has got to be that we submit ourselves to the will of God. And I think, although the unbeliever won't like it, he at least has to respect the fact that we're not trying to sort of be wishy-washy and explain away what seems to be obviously a difficulty to the unbelieving position. Dan hadn't. That has the answer.
No. Far from that, but it seems to me to be at the root is assumptions. It's very hard to overcome people's
right.
assumptions, and all of us included. Almost nobody is aware of the stack of assumptions that they live their life under. So most everybody, including ourselves probably, we assume, or you speak to the unbeliever, somebody who's offended by this ethnic cleansing or other things in the Bible, and the assumption is, I deserve good things, God is wicked here, is mean because he's doing all this, I'm a good person, and a lot of others. So because all these assumptions are there, you said it at the beginning, you were saying, well, why don't we ask, why did he wait 400 years? Why didn't he go earlier? All these assumptions just guide our entire life, but most people aren't aware of them, so it's pretty hard to overcome those on top of this. Everything hangs on the T, once again.
That's right. T is entitled depravity. Yeah, and I think, you know, if you take that approach in terms of what you're saying at the end, you can turn this to an opportunity for evangelism as well and say, you know, even what he said to the Israelites wasn't, I spared you because you were good. They deserved hell as well. It's only the sovereign mercy of God. And the call of the gospel is to turn away from devotion to destruction to life everlasting. That's the offer that's before you. Good.
It doesn't say, by the way, that because the Lord looked ahead in history and saw that you would be...
Right. Faithful. Yeah. If he had looked ahead, he would have seen the book of Judges, and then he would have said, it's all off. Right. No, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Let me just briefly... So the joke in the spring is always like that clock is never adjusted, so we have another hour at this point, but the joke in the fall doesn't work because we're overdue. Where is our pastor? So let's see.
Alan, I had one more question.
Sure. Okay. That's okay. Ask away.
On this current trends and view of images and so on, you mentioned sort of a postmodern... openness to image worship and so on. I don't know if you remember, but I was at my sister's family church. They go to a large evangelical church, and there was this picture that some performance artist had done of Christ, you know, up above the pulpit, which I was a little bit shocked at, you know, because I thought surely they know.
Huh? Yeah.
But. Is that the kind of thing you were thinking of, or were you thinking more of some people bringing back Eastern Orthodox icons or something, or maybe even the move of some evangelicals into Orthodoxy?
It's the latter two. So there is to take the second of those. There has been a movement of some even among Reformed ministers to Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox churches, and I get the impression that it's this sense of a desire for antiquity, which is part of the postmodern flee from overemphasis on rationality to more aesthetic and more something historically rooted. So that's just a vague connection, but that was one. And the other is, I mean, I've seen remember reading about a Baptist church that, you know, introduced all these candles into their sanctuary, and I don't think it was like the Christmas Eve service. It was like this return to the same sort of use of idolatry that you would expect in a church in the Middle Ages instead. So I don't have this was just a let's not write it off altogether kind of thing, as if that's something that only happened in the Reformation. That's all I was getting at. Yep. Okay, just briefly, I actually don't have much in my notes for the last part. Verses 12 through 16 are emphasizing the blessings of the covenant that are tied to this faithfulness that they're being called to. And we've seen these before, and you know, the reference to blessing the fruit of the womb and the fruit of the land. Let me just make the comment that this is specifically an in-your-face address to the Canaanite gods, because the Canaanite gods were the gods of fertility. They provided the fruit of the womb and the fruit of the land, so the Canaanites believed. And the Canaanites actually believed they could manipulate those gods through the use of idols. But God is saying here, no, I am the sovereign one. I will cast out those gods, if you will, and I will bless you myself with great fruitfulness. And of course, it's the sort of blessing that you expect from the Abrahamic covenant, and specifically the mention of the diseases of Egypt. It's an interesting historical fact. You can Google it, that there were some well-known diseases associated with ancient Egypt, specifically skin diseases, eye diseases, and dysentery. So that not giving them the diseases of Egypt is probably a reference to that and not to like the plagues that came on Egypt. But God promises not to lay on them those diseases. And then the last portion, which is verses 17 through 26, encourages them not to fear. Okay? I mean, what they had ahead of them was a daunting task. Okay, there were seven nations in the list given at the first of this, and they could well ask, how can I dispossess them? It was also a bloody task, so some of them might have said, ew, I don't really want to do that sort of thing. But God encourages them first by telling them not to be afraid, but remember what God did in bringing them out of Egypt. Again and again, he comes back to that in Deuteronomy. God showed great power over the mighty powers of Egypt. And so, it says at the end of verse 19, so shall the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. It was that same fear that caused them to halt at Kadesh Barnea, right, at the beginning of Deuteronomy, that was recounted, and refused to go in. And God is calling them not to do that and reminding them that he will show his power. You shall not be terrified among them, for the Lord your God, the great and awesome God, is among you. There could be no greater encouragement in the Christian life individually or in this situation that God was with them, the great and awesome God. There's one other thing mentioned here which is a little bit curious at first, and that's in verses 22 and through 20, or 22 and 23, and that is the promise of gradual defeat. Okay? You might expect, like, we're here cheering them on. You're going to get out there and you're going to wipe them out in a day. Well, no, actually, God says you will be unable to destroy them at once. And the reason given is for their own good, lest the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. So they were actually going to inherit, as we saw before, all of the well-established estates, if you will, all of the houses and the fields and so on. And God says the beasts of the field would be too numerous for you if you overcame them at once. So, you know, we'll let the Canaanites keep them until you get there, and then you can wipe them out, if you want to look at it in that sort of crude way, and it will be yours. So this, as it worked out in history, is described in Joshua. So toward the end of Joshua, there's a list of, so Joshua 15:63 and 16:10, the next to the last line there. There's a list of the nations they still had to take. So in Joshua's time, it was still anticipated that they had more to do. The victory had been secured, and that's an important thing to remember, that the land was conquered, you might say, in the sense of it being a given. But there were still victories to be won. But it's striking that after Joshua died, they failed to persevere in this. And so instead of this being something that would prevent the beasts of the field becoming too numerous for them, God actually judges them for their refusal to go forward. And there are the reference at the end of Joshua 23 and Judges that they refused to clear the inhabitants of the land. And they did become a snare. The inhabitants did become a snare. Psalm 106 specifically says that. So the promise of gradual victory became, because of their refusal to obey in the post-Joshua generation, the difficulty of idolatry that overtook them. So just quickly as an application of that, I think it's very important for us to remember that God works gradually in history and in our own lives. We may think that since it's been 2,000 years since Christ, the gospel should have more influence in the world than it does. Well, the victory was won through Christ. As we read in Romans, the God of peace will soon crush Satan under our feet, but God works on his own timetable, and sometimes it can seem very slow. But it's an encouragement to us to realize that God is still the one in control. And of course, that's also true in our individual lives. Speak for myself, my sanctification seems too slow in many cases. But we should realize that God doesn't bring us to the end, to complete sanctification, until he brings us to glory. He has a reason for doing so, and we should have hope, we should have courage, and we should keep fighting the way the Israelites are called to do here. Okay. Pretty quick on the last part. Any comments or questions about that last bit? Okay. Let's close in prayer.